I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On the day after the election, several headlines focused on polarization. The country is divided, they say. But how divided is it really? What do the results tell us? When you look at the issues that people actually voted for, we're talking about increased taxes in California, legalizing marijuana in Colorado and Washington, legalizing gay marriage in Maine and Maryland, rejecting anti-union proposition in California, a banning funding of Planned Parenthood, actually voting against that in Florida, we see a fairly different picture. So how should the media analyze these results to really understand where we are today? And what about the changing demographics? How are the media covering this? One of today's guests, Juan Gonzalez, in his latest piece, Latinos and Other Minorities Boost President Obama's Margin of Victory, reports that exit polls showed Latinos made up 10% of the electorate. Juan Gonzalez is an award-winning columnist of the New York Daily News and co-host of Democracy Now! He's the author of several books, including Harvest of Empire, A History of Latinos in America. It was recently turned into a full-length documentary, and it will be shown on Monday in San Francisco and Tuesday in Berkeley. And we've got more information about that on our website. Hi, Juan. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you, and I loved your documentary. We'll talk about that later in the show.
Uh-huh.
We were also joined by Chris Tonzin, editor of the Middle East Report, which is published by the Middle East Research and Information Project, and we will talk to Chris about the media's coverage of U.S. foreign policy in this election. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me back.
It's great to have you back. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So, Chris, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I just saw a piece this morning at Gawker, of all places, by someone named John Cook about one of the topics that we're going to discuss, which is the so-called demographic interpretation of the 2012 presidential election. And I thought this piece was very astute in pointing out that that this spin that's been put on the election, that Obama won with a coalition of racial minorities and unmarried women and so on and so forth, basically reifies white men as the only people who can be appealed to on the basis of political issues as opposed to on the basis of their ethnic identity or something else that they can't change about themselves. And you know, in many ways, I think the piece does a good job of pointing out how problematic that interpretation is. Presumably, the Latinos and blacks and others who voted for President Obama did so because they agree with him on the issues and not because of racial factors.
And it's interesting because in past elections, we would hear things like, you know, the soccer mom or the security voter. And now we're getting the white vote, the Latino vote, the black vote. Why do you think the media tend to just put all these people into this little box?
Well, I think part of it, I think we have to say that analysts who are sympathetic to both the Republicans and the Democrats are partly responsible for imposing this spin on political journalism. Journalists, of course, are notoriously susceptible to taking their lead in spinning stories from the people they're covering, whether it's domestic or foreign policy stories. And there are a couple of analysts on the Democratic Party side, and I'm forgetting their names right now, but based at Brookings, who have been pushing this line for a long time, that the Republican Party was consigning itself to electoral oblivion simply because of demographic changes in the country, in particular the rising proportion of Latinos in the country's population. And of course, Bill O'Reilly, Karl Rove, and others on the Republican side have immediately spun the election result this time as basically a function of the declining share of white people in the overall electorate. And I think we really also have to remember that this is a long-time theme in our politics. Going back, I've been reading Nixon Land by Rick Perlstein recently, and I think he does a great job at showing how Nixon was the first national politician to understand that the Republicans and conservative Democrats and other reactionaries like George Wallace could pin their whole electoral strategies on mobilizing the anxieties of white people about no longer being a dominant majority in the United States.
And Juan, it was amazing, actually. I learned about Bill O'Reilly's quote when I was listening to Democracy Now!'s coverage on the day after the election. And these guys did not mince their words when they talked about how this country is no longer a white America. And Bill O'Reilly basically said, you know, if you want things, who are you going to vote for, Barack Obama or Mitt Romney? What are your thoughts about how the media tend to put all of these people in a box, the white vote, the black vote, the Latino vote?
Well, I mean, I think it's been a reality now, not just for in recent years, but for decades upon decades in politics, that racial and ethnic divisions have had a big impact on how people vote. I mean, the mention of Richard Nixon and the Southern strategy that Nixon began and the force grew in the Republican Party of appealing to Southern white former Democrats, part of the old Roosevelt coalition, around the issues of their opposition to racial integration and busing, to affirmative action, became the basis of the power of the Republican Party, appealing to blue-collar white workers in the North and to Southerners who were felt threatened in one way or another by the rising movement for more racial equality and opportunity by African Americans and Latinos. That became the dominant strategy of the Republican Party that, in essence, culminated in 1994 when they captured both houses in Congress. I think what's happened now is that that strategy has proved the limitations, because it too was a strategy based on appealing to certain demographic groups about what they perceived to be their interests, whether they were in reality their interests or not, is subject to debate. But the Republican Party, for better or for worse, became the party that was more welcoming to white men in particular, but other white voters or business people who felt that the Democrats were too willing to cater to other group interests, whether that was African Americans or Latinos or gays or women, and so what's happening now is not new. I think what has happened is that the old strategy has come up against the demographic realities of the changing nature of the country, all political strategies that tend to lump people together in groups opposed to other groups obviously have limitations and have a tendency to at times create emotional appeals but I think that overall they do to some degree represent the fact that certain policies adopted by the Obama administration or by the Republicans in Congress appeal more so to one group or another. Just for instance, take Obamacare, which has often been talked about recently. Few people understand that in the Latino community, Obamacare probably had the biggest impact of any other group in the country, because there was a huge number of working poor Latinos, still is, who are not covered by health insurance. So if it was one group that saw the health care reform bill as something that would bring concrete betterment to their lives, I think it was the Latino community in the United States. So that, while it was a reform for the entire population, it specifically, I think, struck a chord in the Latino community.
And that is Juan Gonzalez, award-winning columnist of the New York Daily News and co-host of Democracy Now! Again, Juan is author of Harvest of Empire. It's been turned into a documentary, excellent documentary, and it's screening this Monday at the Brava Theater, 2781 24th Street in San Francisco, 7 and 9:30, and then on Tuesday at the Grand Lake Theater, 3200 Grand Avenue in Oakland, 4:15, 7 o'clock, and 9:30. And it takes a look at U.S. policy in Latin America and the Caribbean. And we'll talk about that later in the show. And if you'd like to join us, Juan will be with us until 30 after. And if you have any questions or comments specifically about how the media are covering the changing demographics in this country and the changing vote, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. Also, the media keep asking, and the Republicans keep asking, why did they lose? What are your thoughts about that? And just what are your overall thoughts about post-election coverage? Do you think the media have done a good job and just looked at how people voted across the country, not just for president, but at the state and the local levels, to tell us what this really says about where we are. 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment on our website or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Chris Tonzine, editor of the Middle East Report. And before we move on, Juan, I wanted to get your positivity. Where did you see good reporting this week?
Yeah, I saw an excellent report on MSNBC. Jane Timm today has an excellent report titled How the Ground Game Triumphed over Super PAC Millions. And she starts the story off saying that the day before the election, as President Obama was preparing to speak in one of his last rallies in Ohio, the Republicans tweeted to the press and others that they had managed to knock on 75,000 doors that day, in essence, trumpeting their organization. But the Obama campaign people, meanwhile, saying nothing, realized that they had knocked on 376,000 doors that day, five times the number of doors that the Republicans were knocking on in one day. And the story goes on to talk about the huge investment that the Obama campaign made from the very beginning in ground forces. That, for instance, there were as many as 900 full-time workers on the Obama campaign in August, averaging about $36,000 a year salaries, while the Romney campaign had about less than half as many full-time people, but they were getting paid much more, according to the Los Angeles Times, about $77,000 annually. So in essence, her article talks about the really the enormous amount of people-to-people emphasis that the Obama campaign utilized to overcome the financial problems, of course, after Citizens United, of all the PACs and the other organizations throwing money into the campaign on the side of Romney. And it reminded me of an old saying from the rebellious age of the 60s and the 70s that the spirit of the people will overcome the man's technology. That in reality, that the Obama campaign decided that they couldn't compete. I mean, they competed pretty well in terms of money, but they were going to be overspent. But they had a weapon, which was the enormous ability to get young people and others into key battleground states. One example, for instance, I know Larry Hanley, the president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, the main transportation union in the country. He brought 125 of his union members to Ohio for weeks from New York and New Jersey just to knock on doors. To mobilize union households in Ohio. So there was this really huge operation at the ground level that made it possible, it appears, for the turnout in the election to be much higher even than was being predicted in the polls.
Right. And at 30 After, we'll be joined by Time Magazine's Michael Shearer, who's out with a piece called Inside the Secret World of the Data Crunchers Who Helped Obama Win. And so we'll talk more about that. And let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Lee in San Francisco. Hi, Lee. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you. I have a question for you. And actually, I have two questions. And the panel. The first question is, how did Romney and the Republican, no, not Romney, but the Republican Party get to be so out of touch and disconnected? Because presumably they have access to the same level of mechanisms that the Democrats have to ensure that they're connecting with it.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, did you just hear my question?
I did. So how did the Republican Party get so out of touch?
Yeah. And question number two. Mm-hmm. The day after the election, I turn on the radio and the television, and all I hear is fiscal cliff, fiscal cliff.
Right.
And that's what I'm hearing, like a drumbeat. How does the media decide that they're going to glom onto ad nauseum, repeat this cliche until we're just deadened to it? I mean, aren't they aware that nobody listens if you keep saying the same thing over and over again?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up. Actually, President Obama is speaking about the fiscal cliff right now, and we're going to search for that and find out what he's saying. But to your point about the media and the Republican Party, The Atlantic's Connor Friedersdorf has a piece called How Conservative Media Lost to the Mainstream Media and Failed the Rank and File. And he writes, quote, "You haven't just been misinformed about the horse race. Since the very beginning of the election election cycle, conservative media has been failing you. With a few exceptions, they haven't tried to rigorously tell you the truth or even to bring you intellectually honest opinion. What they've done instead helps to explain why the right failed to triumph in a very winnable election. Chris, what are your thoughts on this?
I think that's basically accurate. I would just excuse me, focus on one point in particular, which is I think that one of the ideological appeals that the Obama campaign made was quite effective, in particular in sort of Rust Belt states like Ohio, where they wound up winning with a larger margin than would have been expected, say, a month ago. And that was to paint Mitt Romney as the very embodiment of the rapacious, guiltless, looting style of capitalism, which brought us the 2008 financial crisis and consigned so many Americans to losing their homes and losing their jobs. And that the reason it was so effective is that it happened to be absolutely 100% true. And I think that the conservative media and the Republican Party failed to understand that that kind of appeal would be quite effective, because the fact is most Americans do not play in the stock market. Most Americans, many, many Americans do live paycheck to paycheck. Most Americans are quite vulnerable to catastrophic illness and other sort of life-altering events in a way that Mitt Romney and people of the 1% just will never be. And you know, this gets back to the Occupy movement as well. You know, the first sort of grassroots leftish movement in several years that has managed to make a real impact in the media. And I think that, you know, the conservatives were too quick to sort of write the obituary of that movement. Yes, that movement did fizzle in terms of being a movement, but it did leave its imprint, if nothing else, in this phrase, 1% to 99%, which does resonate widely with a lot of Americans. So I think that that is one way in which conservatives really deluded themselves.
And what are your thoughts on this, Juan? Conservatives often said that the race was very tight, but then the national media also ran with that line.
Right. Well, I mean, I agree that the conservatives really misread what was the general feeling in the nation, and I completely agree that the Occupy movement really changed the national debate, regardless of what it did organizationally or long-lasting. Before the Occupy movement, all the debate was on budget deficits and the danger of the country incurring more budget deficits. But after the Occupy movement, it really sort of focused in on the growing inequality in wealth in America, and to some degree, it seems to me that it did influence the Obama campaign to take a more populist approach. And Obama, wherever he went, kept saying, whatever tax reform is reached, we're going to have to tax the wealthy. And he kept it up, and to the point that he is now insisting that that is, if anything, part of his mandate by winning, that the American people supported him in his insistence that the wealthy, who have had a disproportionate share of their country's wealth now for many decades, must begin to pay some of that back. And I think that that's obviously going to inform the battle over this now fiscal cliff. But the push for austerity and dealing with the budget before Occupy, now the business community wants it once again. I was listening to Jack Welch in an interview on CNN with Piers Morgan a couple of nights ago, marveling at the Obama victory, but saying now President Obama needs to crack heads within his own within his own ranks to reach a bargain or a deal on the fiscal cliff. So the business community now is going once again to press on the need of concessions by the Democrats. Of course, some will have to be made, but the nature of to what concessions will the business community in this country make to pull the country out of its continuing stagnation is going to be critical. And to what degree will the Obama administration maintain that populist stance that I think really got it elected?
And Juan, we have to let you go in a couple of minutes, so I just want to ask you a couple more questions about this. What are your thoughts about the rest of the media? I mean, it's very easy for us to focus on the conservative media and these things that O'Reilly and everyone else says about white America, but what about the rest of the media and also the progressive media that really did spend a large chunk of the last 6 months focusing on Romney, and Ryan, and really didn't spend that much time focusing on President Obama's policies, foreign policies, for example, deportations. What are your thoughts on that?
And I know in Democracy Now we have done quite a bit of that. Not only the targeted assassinations and the mass deportations that the Obama administration was really set records on in terms of the Latino community. But so many other problems, the crackdown on whistleblowers and government, unprecedented for any president, have occurred under President Obama. The failure to really still hold the financial institutions accountable for the enormous damage of the Great Recession of 2008-9. All these things still are big failings of the Obama administration. But I think what happened was that even those who had were upset with the Obama administration, the loss of enthusiasm for Obama was buffeted by the increase in fear of what the Romney presidency and would represent. So right. I think that sort of made up for the lack of enthusiasm for Obama, at least in this election.
Right. And then also, I just wanted to ask you quickly about your documentary, because I think, or the documentary that was made by the same name of your book, Harvest of Empire. And you know what's kind of ironic about all of this, Juan, is this documentary looks at, you know, Colombia, Nicaragua, Cuba, Mexico, and looks at how U.S. policies in those countries, support for torture regimes, for example, U.S. armed invasions, really pushed so many people in those countries to the United States. And it's sort of ironic in a way, because you've got all these conservatives bemoaning sort of brown America now and not really talking about how this happened.
Right. That was the main theme of my book, as well as the theme of the film, which is that you really cannot understand this huge demographic change and massive immigration of people from Latin America to the United States unless you understand the relationship between the United States and Latin America. That just as in France, they have an immigration problem with Tunisians and Algerians and Moroccans, and in England with Indians and Pakistanis and Jamaicans, here in the United States, the huge Latin American presence since World War II is really a direct result of the previous colonial relationship or empire relationship that existed between the metropolis and these third world countries. And so what the documentary attempts to do is tell the story. How did this happen? So that Americans get a clear understanding of how it was, that why is it that there are so many Latinos suddenly in your town that weren't there 10, 15, 20 years ago,
right.
And understand how political policies also affect immigration. It's not just a question of, you know, closing borders or putting up fences, but that policies affect immigration. So, and I think now it's going to be very important, because John Boehner just announced yesterday that suddenly the Republicans have decided they have to tackle immigration reform. So there's going to be a huge debate in 2013 over the new immigration policy in the country, and hopefully the film will be able to contribute to that.
Yes, but unfortunately these dots are rarely connected in the national media, and I'm sure that people would really love to learn about this.
If it gets enough exposure, hopefully, then at least this perspective on it, because we in the film, we interview folks, both prominent Latinos as well as recent immigrants, famous ones like Rigoberta Menchú, the Nobel Prize winner, and Juno Diaz, the Dominican Pulitzer Prize winning writer, but also some of recent migrants over the border
and
tell the story of how and why they came.
Well, thank you. It's a great documentary, and I'll give information right after the break. Juan Gonzalez, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Thank you. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org. They're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org. You can also highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. Join in today's conversation, 866-798-TALK, or an email. That works just as well, to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. And that documentary, Harvest of Empire, The Untold Story of Latinos in America, based on a book by the same name by Juan Gonzalez, will be screened Monday, 7 and 9:30 p.m. at the Brava Theater, 2781 24th Street in San Francisco, and then on Tuesday at the Grand Lake Theater, 3200 Grand Avenue in Oakland, 4:15, 7 o'clock, and 9:30. And you can find more information about this at yourcallradio.org. These are KPFA events. And coming up on Monday, speaking of changing demographics, we will be talking about this. Who are the new voters? How are they changing our politics? And we'll talk about the growth in participation by Latino voters, Black voters, young voters. I'm interested also in single women voters. The number of women voting is definitely on the rise, so we'd love to hear from you on that issue on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And speaking of women voters, Karen just wrote us and said, Rachel Maddow on MSNBC clearly showed that the women's vote made a huge difference. Maybe men should just stop talking so much. Enough is enough. Well, thank you for the email, Karen. And we'll be sure to bring on a woman next Friday to talk about media coverage of that. Today, we are joined by Chris Tonzing, editor of the Middle East Report, published by the Middle East Research and Information Project. And now I would like to welcome Michael Shearer to the show. Michael is White House correspondent for Time Magazine. He previously reported for Salon and Mother Jones, and his latest piece is called Inside the Secret World of the Data Crunchers Who Helped President Obama Win. Hi, Michael. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks again for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. So I just want to ask you, we've been talking about this a bit on the show, and we got a few calls and emails about it. What are your thoughts on the media's portrayal of where the country is right now? Because we've got, increasing taxes in California, legalizing marijuana in Colorado and Washington, legalizing gay marriage in Maine and Maryland. We rejected an anti-union proposition in California. We've now have a Democratic majority in Sacramento. The ban on Planned Parenthood went down in Florida. Tax increases were approved across the board, across the country. How do you think the media are really analyzing these results to understand where we are today?
Well, I think clearly this was a huge progressive win this election, and the contrast is with what happened in 2010, where you had pretty much the opposite happening on the federal level. It also continues a trend we've seen. There's sort of a regional polarization that's happening in this country. A lot of what you just mentioned is happening in California, where the Republican Party is in some ways not even existing anymore. I mean, it's been so pushed to the margins. And there are a number of states now where that's happening with Republicans, especially in the South. The Democratic Party is being marginalized. That, it's a several decade trend now that the parties have each become more ideologically pure and less ideologically diverse within themselves, and that there's just not that much crossover anymore. But clearly, this cycle, this election, was a national move in the other direction, and that was measured really in what came down to be eight states, the swing states in the middle, and they almost all sided on the Democratic side. And then you had in a number of states these state initiatives moving in the liberal direction.
And Chris, we have an email from a listener who says, "Would you say that Tea Party politics as a political strategy has been totally discredited? How would you answer that?"
I don't think totally discredited. I think that's overselling it. I mean, the biggest referendum here was a choice between two people, Mitt Romney and Barack Obama. It wasn't an ideological litmus test. It wasn't a sort of answer with an essay about what you think should be done with debts and deficits and spending in the country. So you can't draw too much there. But it is clear that Republicans overread the mandate they got in 2010 when President Obama really took a drubbing, they made a bet in 2011, in August 2011 during the debt ceiling negotiations, that The concern over spending and deficits and debt was so great in the country that they would rather have the issue than a solution that would lead to some sort of compromise on their part. And it turned out that, and you know, the polling at the time showed that a majority of the country wasn't opposed to raising or returning to the Clinton rates for the wealthiest Americans. Significant parts of the country were really concerned about some of these entitlement cuts and other discretionary spending cuts. But what Obama was able to demonstrate in this election was that that 2010 head of steam for the Tea Party was in some part just steam. The other thing I think that's clear coming out of this is that the no compromise, ideological purity, fight harder mantra that has been driven by the Tea Party within the Republican Party has clearly damaged the party, and the sort of senior people within the Republican Party now have to find a way of fixing this before the next election. You had in 2010 several Senate races, including in Nevada and Delaware and Colorado, where candidates that probably should have won lost because they were just too ideological and they weren't really of a caliber that you need to run for Senate statewide, but they'd been put there by the Tea Party. This cycle, you had at least two major seats that should definitely have gone Republican in Indiana and Missouri, but the candidates who were Tea Party-backed, who the establishment of the Republican Party was clearly nervous about, basically shot themselves in the foot and gave up those seats. And so if this trend continues with the demographic changes that you see happening in the country, the Republican Party is really, you know, on its way to being more of a minority party than it is at this point. And so some of that has to shift. I do think, though, the populism that the Tea Party drove and the energy that they the degree which they re-energized the Republican Party after the Bush years shouldn't be missed. And there have been huge positive effects for Republicans and actually changing the course of the country. You know, the issues of debt and deficit are still front and center. They're going to be front and center for the next several months, and that's in large part due to this, you know, very popular movement.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But Chris, I wanted you to also chime in here on what your thoughts are about the future of the Tea Party, and also because, well, these are two different questions, but because you focus on foreign policy, what does this all mean for coverage of foreign policy? And this election cycle, you heard a little bit about China and a lot about Iran, and that was pretty much it.
Yeah, quickly on the Tea Party, I'm not an expert on these questions by any means, but I think it's tempting at least to read these election results in the following way, that in the course of my lifetime, I'm in my mid-40s, and in the course of my lifetime, the sort of overarching picture of American politics has been that the Republican Party has lurched to the right, at first gradually and then really lurching. And what they've done is that in the process is that they have moved the definition of the political center sharply to the right and really declawed the liberal and progressive wing of the Democratic Party to the point that you know, we got Democrats such as Clinton and Obama, who are very corporate centrist Democrats, who would have been moderate Republicans 30 years ago.
Right.
On economic class issues, on sort of social cultural issues, as sort of the way we live, the relations between the sexes, things like that. The country has moved to the left, simply in part because of demographic changes, in part just because of in part because of the impact, the long-term social impact of the counterculture, all of those things. And so issues that used to be polarizing, like gay marriage and things like that, those things are dying. And the Republican Party knows that, I think. They can't polarize the electorate with things like that anymore, and they won't be able to do so at all a generation from now. But the effect of moving the country so far to the right on the economic and class issues means that there hasn't been, in my lifetime really, there has not been a strongly articulated set of left ideas about how to organize an economy, about things like taxation, policy questions like that. that has been articulated from a presidential platform or from a notable platform in Washington. And that means that those issues are still in play politically. And so I think it's premature in that regard to say that sort of right-wing populist politics like that embodied by the Tea Party is dead. But I do think it's tempting to read the election this time as the Tea Party simply went way too far, that Americans want the government to work. They don't appreciate this kind of political brinkmanship that the Tea Party engaged in. So that is, I hope, that's a hopeful analysis, but I hope it's correct.
I just wanted to add that the majority of the men who shot off about rape lost their elections, their races. Yeah.
Yes, and that's I think also an indicator of how these sort of the ways that the Republicans have tried to polarize the country on social cultural lines are really losing their potency.
Right, and on foreign policy.
On foreign policy, unfortunately, the story I think has to be that if you look at that foreign policy debate, it was really a lot of me too, from Obama and Romney. And the country was not presented with a clear choice, really, on that issue. And so I don't think that one can interpret the election results as meaning anything in particular. I do think that it's very unfortunate that there was silence during the campaign about some very important issues on the world stage, a lot of which happened to be in the region of the Middle East, one of which is the coming confrontation with Iran over its nuclear research program. Another is the coming implosion of Syria under the impact of civil war and the atrocities of the regime there. And another is the relentless and expanding drone warfare that the Obama administration is conducting under the rubric of the War on Terror, which, as we learned from the very detailed series in the Washington Post about a week and a half ago, is putting unprecedented numbers of people, largely in the Muslim world, in the crosshairs of this so-called disposition matrix. And special operations in the military and the CIA are really gaining control over an unprecedented killing machine, which is going to have the same kind of blowback in the long run that previous American interventions in that area of the world have had. And it's unfortunate that that's been really not talked about very much.
Right, and we're definitely going to do a show about this very topic, about drones in the near future. That is Chris Tonzien, editor of the Middle East Report, published by the Middle East Research and Information Project. Michael Shearer is the White House correspondent for Time. And after we take just a couple of phone calls, because you've all been waiting patiently, we will talk with Michael about his piece, Inside the Secret World of the Data Crunchers Who Helped Obama Win. But let's take a few calls and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Nancy in San Francisco. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Rose. How are you? I listen to you all the time.
Thank you.
You know, he's already repeated, both people repeated, we have taken such a lurch leftward the other night. Okay? Forget Obama. He's going to stay in the center. He's going to be right-wing. I mean, he was right-wing the other day compared to what happened in the rest of the country. And I just think it's an opening door for grassroots, for Occupy, for everybody to get out on the streets. And I mean, we have to push the agenda now, okay? I mean, Obama's not listening. Look how stupid he is about the marijuana thing. I mean, how can you do with all of this research and all of the people? And, you know, pot is by de jure legal. I mean, you can get it anywhere, anytime in the whole country forever. Okay, forever. The whole thing is it's stupid. Okay, we have to use this time right now. We can't let it go by to even make it go more leftward, get our single payer, get everything, and we can get it. I think at the local level, up to the state, and just tell the federal government to go screw themselves.
Well, thank you for calling in. Actually, Democracy Now! Had a good conversation about this morning. How will the federal government react to Colorado and Washington legalizing marijuana? And I believe a representative from Colorado said they were having a phone call with the attorney general to figure out, are you going to crack down on us like you've cracked down, for example, in Oakland at Oaksterdam? So we will be watching that very closely. And then also, you might want to check out a piece by Will Salatin over at Slate. He had a piece called Cheer Up GOP. We just reelected a Republican president. And we'll put that on our website after the show. Thanks for the call, Nancy. Let's go next to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Yes, good morning. I would like to say that at CW, we don't have so much elections. The series of competing propaganda broadsides that come on our television and non-recyclable flyers that come in our mail, and none of this really informs us about the issues.
Wait, you can't recycle those flyers?
No, they're on quoted paper. I don't believe you can recycle quoted paper. Anyway, there's very little substance, and voters really don't have the facts. So people don't understand, you know, the basic role, say, of undocumented migrants in the society, or what tax rates were under Eisenhower or anything like that. It's not explained because we have, as Cornel West said on Democracy Now!, a Rockefeller Republican as president, and the other ones are just Looney Tunes. And unfortunately, a large section of the population really doesn't understand anything. And the people that, the so-called progressives are really, progressive is a term now for what used to be called like wishy-washy liberal, and there's nobody really coming up with any sort of integrity.
Well, thank you for calling, Harry. We'll get a response in just a minute. And we're doing a proposition show next Thursday. Let's hear next from Roger in San Francisco. Hi, Roger.
Yes, thank you, Rose. I think I can answer the lady's question about why the Republicans are only seeing one issue. It's simply because they live on this island of thought. Some people call it the bubble. But Democrats, liberals, progressives are in danger of falling into that same trap. You have to listen to both sides. As painful as it might be, it's important to listen to both sides. Also, I'd like to make a suggestion. We are on a financial cliff. I'm sure that the government is going to postpone it for a year. They're not going to allow this country to go down that way. But there's two things you can do. At least for controlling war that we get into. First of all, within 90 days, any conflict we get into has to be paid for. You have to enact something in the tax code that people have to pay for it. No more charging of wars like we did with Iraq. The second thing, we have to get the people involved in it. You have to bring back the draft. I was a volunteer. I never was subject to a draft. I always joined the Marines. But if you bring back the draft, people will start thinking more carefully about getting into conflicts if their own children are going to be involved.
All right. Well, Roger, thank you for calling. That might be for another show about the future of the military. And I also, Michael, wanted to ask you, before we talk about your piece, we had a question about the fiscal cliff this morning. President Obama did give a talk about this, and we just found some comments from Twitter. He says, quote, "I'm committed to solving our fiscal challenges, but I refuse to accept any approach that is not balanced. If we're serious about reducing the deficit, we have to combine spending cuts with revenue. A lot of people are concerned that he's going to go after Social Security and Medicare. What are your thoughts about how the media are going to cover this very important issue?"
Well, there's going to be a ton of coverage over the next couple months, and chances are nothing will be fully resolved in the next couple months. There'll be a ton of coverage next year. I mean, I'm expecting that to be a good part of what I do over the next year, is covering this. There will be, I mean, President Obama has already put on the table last summer changes to Medicare and changes to Social Security, and Speaker Boehner has put on the table revenues, although exactly how you get to those revenues are not entirely clear. And so really we're in a situation where there is a Republican House, a Democratic Senate, Democratic White House, and there's two ways they can go. They could either come to a deal that would include, as the president says, cuts to spending, which means in real terms cuts to entitlements, and new revenues, although how they define those new revenues and where they come from is a little up for debate, or continue deadlock. And the second option is certainly not a good one for the country. And the debate over the first one is exactly where on the slide you put the revenue versus cuts. And that's what is happening right now. The president and Speaker Boehner and other Republicans are doing their initial posturing. The good news is that these guys have been looking at the exact same numbers for 2 years now. They know all the possibilities about this outcome. They know all the variations. They know how to solve this thing, and they know that it's going to be painful on both sides to do it, and there's going to be a lot of anger if they do go forward on both sides. It, you know, it could be more anger on one side or more anger on the other because we don't know exactly where it'll come down. But that's what they've got to figure out how to do, and there's a good solid chance that they figure out how to at least get the top line numbers of how much will be cut and how much new revenue will come and maybe even where the tax rates should be before the end of this year.
In the New York Times, Paul Krugman says he should let Republicans go off the cliff and accept no grand bargain.
Right. You know, that's something that you're going to hear more of from the left. And actually, the advantage right now, if the advantage last year in 2011 was in the Republican side because, you know, if nothing happened, the country would default. And cut and spending would be cut, and the president wasn't going to allow that to happen. So his back was up against the wall. It's arguable that this time around, Republicans' backs are up against the wall because if nothing happens, then the cuts that will automatically be enacted will hit more harshly on the military than on domestic policy, domestic programs, and the tax increases will be automatic. They happen if Congress is unable to act and come to any agreement. Everyone's taxes go up pretty dramatically if you're in one of the higher tax brackets after the new year. And so the White House designed this in a way that they thought have more leverage going into this set of negotiations than they did in the last. And that's probably true, although still that doesn't mean the president's going to be able to get a compromise that will make everyone in his Democratic House, all the Democratic House members, or you know the progressive groups that support his election, very happy, and because you know the realities of spending and our growing costs and our not so fast growing tax base is that we cannot afford what we've promised, particularly seniors and Social Security and Medicare, and it's far more important in Medicare, but we just cannot provide it at current taxation levels. So
well, cool. And we're also going to do a show about this. And again, the first decade of the Bush tax cuts cost $955 billion. The Obama extension cost $229 billion. I think during this debate, it's important to repeat those numbers. And I wanted to also ask you about your piece, Michael, Inside the Secret World of the Data Crunchers Who Helped Obama Win. I didn't expect you to lead with a story about the chance to dine in Hollywood with George Clooney, but what did these Democratic advisors learn from Obama's gatherings with George Clooney?
Yeah, so the point of this whole story is that analytics and analyzing data and collecting data was enormously important to Obama's win, and they were able as a campaign to do things that no other campaign has ever done. And one example came in these really teeny decisions that get made every day. You would think the campaign, someone is sitting in a room just making stuff up. In fact, they were looking at data to make all the as many decisions as they could as this campaign went forward. So they had started doing something in 2007 and 2008 where they would offer contests to have dinner with Barack. You give a small contribution to the campaign, which gets you into their list. They can continue to ask you for money, and you get entered into a drawing, and if you win the drawing, you get to go have dinner with Barack Obama. They found that actually worked very well in getting people to give money who wouldn't normally give money, and so they tried to do it this year with George Clooney. It was enormously successful. The Clooney dinner in Hollywood raised something like $15 million,
wow,
the biggest single fundraiser they had. And so they were looking for a way of replicating that success, and so they started looking at the data. Who had been giving the most to enter these contests? And they found the answer was very clear. Women between the ages of 40 and 49 on the West Coast.
Hmm.
And they were surprised. Well, why is there a regional aspect to this? Well, maybe people are more interested in entering contests when the win is actually kind of close to their house. You know, people in California are more likely to want to go to Hollywood to have dinner with George Clooney than someone in Alaska or Maine. And so they thought, well, maybe we can replicate this on the East Coast. And so they went looking for a celebrity. And so here's the decision. Instead of just finding another celebrity to have dinner with, they went looking for a celebrity based on the data they had. And the person they landed on was Sarah Jessica Parker of Sex and the City. She was based in New York, so they'd have a whole new region to play with. And she appealed to a similar demographic, women between the ages of 40 and 49. And so all through the campaign this year, in ways that the public just had no visibility on because they never talked about it as a campaign, so many of the little tiny decisions that the campaign made were based on really detailed and complicated analysis of data that just didn't exist 8 or 12 years ago in presidential campaigns.
So it's amazing that this goes back to George Clooney and Sarah Jessica Parker and celebrities. And so when you look at these women, 40 to 49, who paid money to eat with George Clooney or Sarah Jessica Parker, these women then went out to vote. And we'll talk about this next week, but this was a significant voting block, right?
Oh, it was a huge voting block, and especially unmarried women were an enormous asset in a number of these swing states for the president. And, you know, one of the ironies here, maybe not irony, but one of the changes that's happened is that if you go back to the last close incumbent reelect we had in 2004, social issues like abortion and gay marriage played largely on the Republican field. There's a, you know, a lot of analysis that says Bush won Ohio in 2004 largely because there was a same-sex marriage amendment on the ballot. And same-sex marriage was banned in Ohio that year, and it pulled out a lot of evangelical voters who might not have otherwise voted. In 2012, it really has shifted clearly, and the social issue advantage was to the Democrats, and that was in large part because there was this huge concern among women, especially unmarried women, in a lot of these swing states about the rhetoric, not just the policies, but the rhetoric of the Republican Party, and there was a real backlash there.
And do you think, we have a question from a listener, do you think that the scapegoating of women, for example, of gays, do you think that the media will continue to allow this and to just to give these Republicans a voice like we have heard over the last year or so?
I don't know. I mean, I cover Washington, so I cover what happens. And if, you know, someone like Richard Murdoch and Indiana is saying something that is offensive, I'm writing about what he's saying, so I guess I'm facilitating it in that way. And my expectation would be that the media continues to facilitate that. The question is whether the Republican Party will continue to facilitate it, because it's clear, right, not just on those issues, but also on immigration and, right, appealing to Latino votes, that they really did themselves some harm. And I would expect fully over the next year that the party itself tries to rein some of this in, because it's so clear now to so many of them the damage that can be done.
Michael Scherer, White House correspondent with Time Magazine. You can find his piece about the Democratic data crunchers on our website. Chris Tonzing, editor of the Middle East Report. Chris, we'd love to have you back for our drone show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. And here's what's coming up on Monday. Who are the new voters, and how are they changing our politics? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about the growth and participation by Latino, Black, young, and single women voters in 2012. What's the most effective way to reach these new voters and keep them involved after the election? What do you think of the changing demographics in this country? And do you think the media understand these voters any better than the Romney campaign did? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Coming up on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI, President Obama wins a second term. We'll assess the president's victory and discuss what lies ahead with commentators Connie Rice and Michael Fontroy. George Johnson brings us his 3-minute sports drill, and Bill Banfield highlights the music of jazz pianist Billy Childs on the next Tavis Smiley Show from PRI.
Next time on Smiley and West from PRI.
We'll have highlights from our celebration in Chicago on Thursday, November the 8th. Doc and I will be joined by Democracy Now! Host Amy Goodman as we look at poverty, power, and the public airwaves.
Plus, we will analyze the results of this week's election. And don't forget to vote if you haven't already.
It's all next time on Smiley and West from PRI.
The Tavis Smiley Show beginning in an hour at noon, following that at 1 o'clock. Smiley and West here on local public radio, KALW San Francisco. It's 11 o'clock.
Hello, this is World Have Your Say. I'm Ben James. This is an international conversation open to you live on the BBC.
I am always averse to the language of exclusion, when what we are called to is to love in the same way as Jesus Christ loves us.
That's the new man in charge of the world's 80 million Anglican Christians. Former oil executive Justin Welby is the new Archbishop of Canterbury. What do you want from him in his new job? Post on facebook.com/worldhaveyoursay to give us your ideas. Also,
India is very successfully developing as an economy, and our development relationship needs to evolve to match that.
Does India deserve foreign aid? Lots of you are talking about the British government's decision to stop giving money by 2015. So tell us, would you support your country's cash going to India?